Recently, Josh traveled to the Republic of South Africa to participate in a history-making Muslim-Christian debate. Before hearing the actual debate in its entirety, listen to this introductory portion of a report which Josh made immediately following his return to the United States.
We received a letter from a businessman that runs a pharmacy in Durban, South Africa, the home of an exceptionally large Muslim population, mainly Indian Muslim, the largest mosque in the Western Hemisphere is there. And this man asked, he said, is there any way you could come over to silence one of the critics here in Durban? There was a man ahead of the Islamic Propagation Center by the name of Ahmad Didat. And over a period of about 10 years, he had totally embarrassed the Christians. He had debated one after another and just ground them into the ground, embarrassed them and ridiculed them and wrote in a way that they were just totally embarrassed. And he said, we have been praying and something needs to happen. And we just want to know if you will be able to come over and debate this individual. Then we got a letter of invitation from the gentleman that he had written about, Mr. Ahmad Didat, the head of the Islamic Propagation Center of Durban, South Africa, challenging me to come over for a debate on Islam versus Christianity view of the crucifixion and resurrection. And after a time of prayer and consultation, we called over there, and the staff of Campus Crusade, other missionaries in there, were quite excited about it because of the reputation this man had developed in South Africa. So we accepted the debate, and we settled on, wasn't the best time for me, but the 30th of August at 2:30 in the afternoon. The place chosen was the what's called the Sugar Bowl Tennis Stadium, the Westville Stadium in Durban, South Africa, an outdoor location that held about 10 to 12,000 people. So we started planning for the debate, and it was a whole new area for me. I knew very little about Islam, but I knew for 1 year, night and day, I would have to discipline myself in getting to know Islam inside and out, because I never take a debate unless I know my opponent's position better than he does. And that takes a lot of research, a lot of listening, a lot of studying. And so for 1 year, we probably spent, I don't know how many thousands of dollars in research. And Mark Lindeen, a fellow from San Diego who's my research director, just did an unbelievable job. We were all set, and yet it seemed like Satan had done everything. I was in Lake City with about 50 families for a vacation, my wife and me, and I left Lake City and got to Denver, connecting to Boston to go over to London and finally get to South Africa. And I got in a plane, and I developed severe chest pains. And I mean, I thought, oh no. So as soon as I got, I had to catch a taxi immediately to the emergency ward at the hospital and found out I had bronchitis. And here I'm sitting there, and they say, well, you don't dare to get in a plane with the cabin pressure, everything else. And man, I walked in the fastest way to get in the hospital and just say you got chest pains. And they didn't even, no paperwork, nothing. They slapped me in the bed. And they started stripping my clothes and put all these suction cups all over me and everything else. And all of a sudden, going on all these instruments. And found out my heart was okay. Had been forgiven. And they said, you have bronchitis, and we recommend you don't fly. And what do you do in a situation like that? So finally I said, give me some painkiller. I need to go. And so I said, I can check in with a doctor. We got a five-hour layover in Boston. And then we had a problem. We could not get visas. South Africa is probably one of the hardest countries to get into in the free world because of the apartheid and the racial situation and all. And now, of course, what's happening in Angola. And so we tried everything. We got our visas in, passports and all. And it came up to 2 weeks ago, no visa. We kept calling the consulate. They said no. Found out that there were several problems. One, I had studied in a Marxist indoctrination center in Latin America, where Che Guevara and Fidel Castro studied. And as a result of several of the people coming to Christ, I was thrown out, and they planted a young lady through a 15-year-old girl in front of my car, and I was arrested and thrown in prison in Mexico. And as a result, I went to the Marxist school, not because I was going to become a Marxist, but I knew I was going to be debating communists in Latin America, and I wanted to get it right from the horse's mouth. Well, as a result of that, I was put on one of the lists of the subversive elements within the United States. And so when the consulate examined that, they discovered it, and so they pretty well decided no. So we called South Africa, and they got several of the top officials in South Africa several of which had come to Christ through my book, Evidence of Demand of Verdict. And they went down and got permission for us at least to get to South Africa. So we got into London and our visas were there. At least the telegram saying that we could get in. And so we flew into South Africa a week ago and arrived at the airport, and they had visas waiting for us. But then I found out that several of these key men had to go in and almost sign their lives away. Character references for me and everything else, and I had to pledge that I would not make derogatory statements against the South African government, against the racial situation. In no way would I polarize the Christian Islam community, because there was so much friction and tension there anyway. Well, for me, it was like not being able to say anything. Because if any of you know me, if there's one thing that burns me, it's racism. And I will not speak to a segregated audience. I will not live in a segregated place, and I will not eat in a segregated restaurant. And so they understood that policy, and I went, and every meeting was open to anyone that wanted to come. So we arrived there, and on the first day I met with several people that were quite informed on the Islam community and my opponent, Didat. So we met for about 4 or 5 hours as they helped to bring me up to date. And from there we went to Cape Town to do a university there, the University of Western Cape, which is one of the most radical universities, probably the number two radical university in South Africa. And it's a black university, mainly blacks and Indians that went there. And it was quite thrilling because we had sent a manual over. We have a manual about this thick, and when people invite me to a university, it takes them 6 months to 9 months to get ready for the series. And we pretty well expected them to go by the manual, even though it was a different culture, different country, different continent, everything. And you know, they did it. It was thrilling. They had their buttons made and everything, and every blackboard in that university had written on it, Josh is coming, how do you spell relief, J-O-S-H, and everything else all through the university. They had big banners out, posters, everything. They had the follow-up all set. They had all the letters ready to go out within 2 hours, and when I finished speaking, they had this everything all set. And I went into this little room, and all of a sudden, all the committee heads, the prayer heads, and everything else started coming in. We had a word of prayer there. And I have to admit that I expected maybe 300, 350 to come out. There were 4,000 students in the university. And I expected about 350 to come out. I was speaking on two subjects. First, the resurrection. Second, Marxism versus Christianity, which was a hot subject in that university because it was the kind of the hotbed of turmoil. And so I went over and I expected about 350, and yet they had saturated that campus everywhere you went. So I walked in, there were about 300 there, about 10 minutes ahead of time, and I thought to myself, well, that's about what I expected. And by the time the meeting was to start, they came up and said, and I had my back towards most of the people. It was a gymnasium, then a big set of bleachers and everything going up. And they said, can we move the podium further back? And I turned around, and the place was jammed. And it kept moving, kept moving. That afternoon, 3,700 of the 4,000 students came up. It's probably the greatest number ever in history in the university. I mean, to come out in one afternoon, and they had a total of about 650 to follow up as a result of that meeting. And it was thrilling. You couldn't even get in the doors. The doors were jammed out into the halls, everything. And the thrilling thing was to see the entire audience just change right before your eyes. To sort of antagonism and a little bit of animosity towards Americans, to turning to respond to the love of Jesus Christ. Then we had various executive meetings, and these were top-notch businessmen invited to come and hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, and every single meeting was sold out 2 weeks ahead of time. And probably one of the neatest things was the first executive meeting in Cape Town, a very, very sharp businessman, looked like he was going to the bank for a loan, came up to me and he said, I want to express my appreciation to you and the Campus Crusade for Christ. And I said, why? He said, I was a dyed-in-the-wool racist. He says, a year ago, I was just totally driven my entire life by hatred for the black man. And he said, somebody shared the four spiritual laws with me, one of the staff at Campus Crusade, and said, I prayed that prayer with him. And he said, Josh, I can't even explain how it happened. But he said, within 6 months, I have developed such a love for the black person. And he said, to me, it's just an absolute miracle. And you know, as he shared his testimony, it confirmed to me that the greatest need today in the world is to confront people with the living person of Jesus Christ. Well, we went from there to Durban. Now, you have to understand, a whole year of preparation. I think Dottie, my wife, could testify that hardly a minute went by that I wasn't thinking of the debate. I dreamed it. I slept it because I knew what it meant to Durban, South Africa. And as soon as we got to Africa, it was pouring rain. The most rain in 100 years. We flew to Durban. Now, Durban is the dry month, August. Totally dry, never rains, it's beautiful. Oh, some of the most gorgeous beaches in all the world. And we got off the plane, it was raining. That was on a Thursday. We went to another Indian university made up of about 90% were either Muslims or Hindus. And it was right during the Muslim prayer hour, and it was the only time I could be there to speak. And so we didn't have much of a crowd. We had 150 out. It was a very small university. But of that 150, and almost totally Muslim and Hindu, they have 85 to follow up out of 150. And I just wish, I'll have them later, but I wish I'd had the comment cards here. Of one Hindu, one Muslim after another saying, today for the first time I'm going to consider Jesus Christ or something like that. And he had 85 to follow up out of that one meeting. But it was pouring rain. Friday, pouring rain. Saturday, the debate was Sunday afternoon at 2:30. Saturday, pouring cats and dogs. It was all I could do to motivate myself to finish my studying and to get my notes down and get them all set for the debate. Well, we had prayed. Ethan Pope, who is here, sitting right there in a maroon shirt, was with me, and my advance man, Charlie Shirley, went over with me. And we met that night, and we prayed, and we really believed it was going to be sunshining, didn't we, Ethan? Well, I got up the next morning. I went to bed about 2:30 and woke up about 9, 9:15, and I just knew God wasn't going to let a year go by and an opportunity and for this debate. And I went over, and with all the faith in the world, I whipped that curtain back, and it was pouring cats and dogs. Worse than any other time, and the fog had moved in. You couldn't see over one block. Now, I can't even begin to tell you what I felt like. Well, I wish I could stand up here and say that I exercised faith, and I just said, well, thank you, God. I know the sun's going to come out. I didn't. Went in and talked with Ethan and them. We had a word of prayer, and then we started to rationalize. We started to think of all the reasons why God permits it to rain, you know, is the only way to get me to South Africa and this and that. It was still worth it just because of the meetings we'd already. And we rationalized. And then I was thinking probably the biggest step of faith I had last year is that I knew I had to prepare for 2 hours on my knees to have my mind set for going into the debate. But it was pouring rain, and your emotions was at the bottom. So I went in, and I got down on my knees, and I decided, boy, I better do this on my knees. So I got on my knees, and I thanked the Lord for the situation, thanked him whether it was a debate or not, and then I just tried to put my whole heart and mind into the debate material that I had before me. There were 5 things that I prayed to God about, one, that he had let me be positive. I did not want to say one negative thing about my opponent, about the Quran, about Islam, or any Muslim whatsoever. I wanted to be totally positive. Second, I wanted to be honest. I wanted to be honest in the way I handled the facts, not overstating my case. Third, I wanted to be loving. I wanted a genuine, sincere love for my opponent. And I wanted the audience to sense that love. Now, that's often difficult as an American because as Americans in cultures like in Africa, we can appear to be very abrasive, especially people like me. I'm very outgoing. I say what I think. And here in this country, I can be abrasive, let alone in Africa. And I just said, Lord, you've got to do something supernatural in my heart, my actions. Fourth, I wanted to be gracious. And fifth, I wanted to be personal. Because I'm convinced that a man with an argument is always at the mercy of a man with an experience. And so I wanted to be able to communicate my testimony. And it must have been 10 minutes later, Charlie Shirley yells out, he says, the sun's coming out! And looked out, and there was a little ray of sun. And within 15 to maybe, 30 minutes, the sky cleared up, and just every cloud went away, and just the sun came out. Hotter than all get out. And it just dried everything off about 2.5, 3 hours before the debate. Well, I mean, I can't tell you how my blood just started pumping and tying like that. Then, about, maybe 45 minutes before we left the hotel to go to the debate, I received a phone call. from the front desk of the Holiday Inn there and said, "Are you Mr. McDowell?" I said, "Yes." I said, "We have a telegram. Oh, telex. There's been there's an emergency. There's been a car accident, and your son has been killed." Well, let me tell you, I can't tell you how my heart just dropped. And then she said, "Oh, wait a minute. No, not your son. It's the son of a friend of yours was killed." You know, it was almost like God took my son away and gave him back to me. Boy, I wanted to crawl right through that telephone all the way back to the United States and hug my Sean at that moment. Well, it just took me emotionally down and then back up again. And we left for the debate, and about 6,500 came to the debate. We would have had 10 or 12,000 if it hadn't been raining. But the rain from a lot of people coming from afar, they just figured there would be no debate. And we showed up at the debate, and it was the first time they'd ever had a debate that there were more Christians than Muslims there. It was always 20% Christians, 80% Muslims, and this time it was about 60-40. The debate was set up where each one of us had 50 minutes, and then 8-minute rebuttal, and then 3-minute closure. And whoever went second was not supposed to take advantage of the second position. In other words, you were not supposed to add anything that was already not prepared to be said. And the gentleman that, the man that I debated, had a lot of charisma, very likable, but very deceptive. Very cutting individual. I mean, boy, he had a way with words. And in fact, the last man that he debated sued him for character defamation and won the case in a court of law. The man was that vicious, and especially when he got the audience on his side. So he started out.
وَقُلْ جَاءَ الْحَقُّ وَزَهَقَ الْبَاطِلُ إِنَّ الْبَاطِلَ كَانَ زَهُوقًا وَنُنَزِّلُ مِنَ الْقُرْآنِ مَا هُوَ شِفَاءٌ وَرَحْمَةٌ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَلَا يَزِيدُ الظَّالِمِينَ إِلَّا خَسَارًا. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, on the subject of crucifixion, the Muslim is told in no uncertain terms in the Holy Quran, the last and final revelation of God. He is told, وَمَا قَتَلُوهُ وَمَا صَلَبُوهُ, that they didn't kill him nor did they crucify him. ولكن شبه له, but it was made to appear to them so. وَإِنَّ الَّذِينَ اخْتَلَفُوا فِيهِ لَفِي شَقٍ مِّنْهُمْ, and those who dispute therein are full of doubts. مَا لَهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ عِلْمٍ, they have no certain knowledge. إِلَّا اتِّبَعَ الظَّنِّ, they only follow conjecture. Guess what? وَمَا قَتَلُوهُ يَقِينًا, for of a surety they killed him not. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, could anyone have been more explicit, more dogmatic, more uncompromising in stating a belief than this, I ask you? Impossible. The only one who was entitled to say such words is none other than the all-knowing, omniscient Lord of the universe. The Muslim believes this authoritative statement as the veritable word of God. And as such, he asks no questions and he demands no proof. He says, these are the words of my Lord, Amanna Saddakna. I believe and I affirm. But the Christian responds, in the words of our honorable guest, in his book, Josh McDowell and Don Stewart, in Answers to Tough Questions, on page 116 and 17, he states the Christian attitude towards this uncompromising statement of the Muslim. He says, a major problem with accepting Muhammad's account is that his testimony is 600 years after the event occurred, while the New Testament contains eyewitness or first-hand testimony of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. In a nutshell, the Christian says, that how can a man 8,000 miles away from the scene of the happening of the crucifixion and 600 years in time away from the happening, how could he know what happened in Jerusalem? The Muslim responds that these are the words of God Almighty, and therefore as such God knew what had happened. The Christians naturally reasons that, look, had we accepted this book, the Quran, as the word of God, there would have been no dispute between us. We would all have been Muslims. We have eyewitness and hear witness accounts of these happenings, which are stated for us in the Holy Bible, most especially in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, the implication of this crucifixion is this, that it is alleged that Jesus Christ was murdered by the Jews by means of crucifixion 2,000 years ago. And as such, the Jews are guilty of the murder of Jesus Christ. We Muslims are told that they are innocent because Christ was not killed nor was he crucified. And as such, I am given the brief by the Holy Quran to defend the Jews against the Christian charge. I am going to defend the Jews against this charge this afternoon, not because they are my cousins, but simply because justice must be done. We have our points of differences with the Jews. That is a different question altogether. This afternoon, I will try my very best to do justice to my cousins, the Jews. Now, in this argument, in this debate, this dialogue, I am actually the defense counsel for the Jews, and Josh McDowell is the prosecuting counsel. And you, ladies and gentlemen, are the ladies and gentlemen of the jury. And I want you to sit back, relax, and at the end of it, give judgment to yourself, to your own conscience, whether the Jews are guilty or not of the charge as alleged by the Christians. Now, to get to the point, as a defense counsel for the Jews, I could have had this case against the Jews dismissed in just 2 minutes in any court of law in any civilized country in the world, simply by demanding from the prosecuting counsel the testimonies of these witnesses, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and when they are presented in the form of affidavits, sworn affidavits, as we have them in the Gospels, I could say that these sworn affidavits, in their original, they are not attested. And the proof, you get any authorized King James Version of the Bible, and you will find it beginning, each and every affidavit begins, the Gospel according to St. Matthew, the Gospel according to St. Mark, the Gospel according to St. Luke, the Gospel according to St. John. I am asking, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what is this according? Do you know what it means? It means Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't sign their name. It is only assumed that these are their words. And as such, in any court of law, in any civilized country, they would be thrown out of court in just 2 minutes. Not only that, I can have this case dismissed twice in 2 minutes. In any court of law, in any civilized country. I said twice. Because Mark, one of the testators, in the Gospel of St. Mark, chapter 14, verse 50, he tells us that at the most critical juncture in the life of Jesus, all his disciples forsook him and fled. All. Bamshiabong ke babalega. Says, to het almal hum farlat en khaflah. If they were not there, the testimony of those who were not there to witness what happened will be thrown out of court. I said twice in 2 minutes, in just 120 seconds flat, the case would be over. in any court of law in any civilized country in the world. But where is the fun of it? You have come along from far and wide after all the threatening rain, and now we say the case is closed and go home. Where is the fun of it? To entertain you, I am going to put these witnesses. I will accept those documents as valid for the sake of this dialogue. And we are now going to put these witnesses into the box for cross-examination. And I want you to see where truth lies. The first witness that I'm going to call happens to be Saint Luke. And Saint Luke has been described by Christian authorities as one of the greatest of historians. As a historical book, the Gospel of Saint Luke is unique. Now, we get Saint Luke, chapter 24, verse 36, and we ask. I'm going to tell you what he has said, what he has written in black and white. He tells us that it was Sunday evening, the first day of the week, that Jesus Christ, he walked into that upper room, the one in which he had the Last Supper with his disciples. This is 3 days after his alleged crucifixion. He goes in and he wishes his disciples, "Peace be unto you." Shalom Aleichum in Hebrew, Salam Aleikum in Arabic, Ugutula Gubenina in Zulu, Frida Fayela in Afrikaans, "Peace be unto you." And when he said "peace be unto you," his disciples were terrified. "Is that true?" we are asking Luke. And he said, "Yes." I would like to ask him, why were the disciples terrified? Because when one meets his long-lost master, his grandfather, his guru, his rabbi, we Eastern people, we embrace one another, we kiss one another. Why should his disciples be terrified? So Luke tells us, he says, they were affrighted because they thought he was a spirit. I'm only quoting what he said, and you can verify in your own Bibles at home. They were affrighted, they were terrified, because they thought he was a spirit. I'm asking Luke, did he look like a spirit? And he says, no. I'm asking all the Christians of the world, again and again, of every church and denomination, this master of yours, did he look like a spirit? And they all say, no. Then I said, why should they think the man is a spirit when he didn't look like one? And everyone is puzzled. Unless Josh can explain. Every Christian is puzzled. Why should they think the man is a spirit when he didn't look like one? I will tell you. The reason is, because the disciples of Jesus, they had heard from hearsay that the master was hanging on the cross. They had heard from hearsay that he had given up the ghost. In other words, his spirit had come out. He had died. They had heard from hearsay that is dead and buried for 3 days. All their knowledge was from hearsay. Because, as I said at the beginning, Mark chapter 14, your other witness, verse 50, he says that at the most critical juncture in the life of Jesus, all his disciples forsook him and fled. All. That they were not there. So, all their knowledge being from hearsay, you come across such a person about whom you have heard that he has been in bed for 3 days, you assume that he is thinking in his grave. Such a person, when you see, naturally you are terrified. So Jesus wants to assure them that is not what they are thinking. They are thinking that he has come back from the dead, a resurrected spiritualized body. So he says, and I'm only quoting what Luke said, he says, "Behold my hands and my feet. Have a look at my hands and my feet, that it is I myself." Pagani, Zanglazani, Nesniozani, Udimini, Noko. He says, "Take now my hand and my foot, but it is itself." And the same for a man, What's wrong with you?
Why are you afraid? Say, handle me and see. Handle me and see. For a spirit has no flesh and bones as you see me have.
A spirit. Indefinite article. A spirit means any spirit.
Has no flesh and bones as you see me have.
So, if I have flesh and bones, in that case, I'm not a spirit, I'm not a ghost, I'm not a spook. I'm asking the Englishman, the one who speaks English as his mother tongue. If I have flesh and bones, in that case, I'm not a spirit, I'm not a ghost, I'm not a spook. I said, is that what it means in your language? One earth, yes, there's a neat place in Vienna, so was jealous seeing that it hit me. I said, you Afrikaner. When a man tells you that, does it mean that he is not what you are thinking? That he's not a spirit, he's not a ghost, he's not a spook. And everybody responds, yes. If a man tells you a spirit has no flesh and bones, it means it has no flesh and bones. As you see me have, I have these things, so I'm not what you're thinking. You are thinking that I was dead and I have come back from the dead, resurrected. A spirit has no flesh and bones. In other words, he's telling you that the body that you are seeing, it is not a metamorphosed body, it is not a translated body, it is not a resurrected body. Because the resurrected bodies get spiritualized. You'd like to know who says so? I said, Jesus. Who says so? My authority is Jesus. You say, where? I said, look, you look again. Chapter 20, verse 36. What does he say? I said, you see, the Jews were always coming to him with poses, with riddles. They were always asking him, Master, shall we pay tribute to Caesar or not? Master, this woman, we found her in the act. What shall we do to her? Master, again and again. Now they come to him and they ask him, he says, Master, Rabbi in the Hebrew language, Master, we had a woman among us, and this woman, according to a Jewish custom, had 7 husbands. You see, according to a Jewish custom, if a brother, a man dies, and leaves no offspring, then the second fellow takes her to wife. And when he fails, the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth, and the seventh, 7 guys had this woman as a wife. But there was no problem while on this earth, because it was all one by one. Now they want to know from him that at the resurrection, in the hereafter, which guy is going to have her because they all had her here? In other words, there will be a war in heaven because we believe that we will all be resurrected simultaneously, all together, one time. And if these 7 brothers wake up at the same time and they see this woman, and everyone will say, Mefro, it's my wife, Umka, me, it's my wife, and there'll be a war in heaven between the brothers for this one woman. So they want to know from him which guy is going to have her on the other side. Luke chapter 20, verse 36. Check it out. In answer to that, Jesus says about these resurrected men and the women, he says, neither shall they die anymore. In other words, once they are resurrected, they will be immortalized. This is a mortal body. It needs food, shelter, clothing, sex, rest. Without these things, mankind perishes. That body will be an immortalized body. An immortal body. No food, no shelter, no clothing, no sex, no rest. He says, neither shall they die anymore, for they are equal unto the angels. In other words, they will be angelized. They will be spiritualized. They will be spiritual creatures. They will be spirits. For they are equal unto the angels and the children of God. Such are the children of the resurrection. Such. Spirits. He says, a spirit has no flesh and bones, as you see me have. In other words, I am not resurrected. And they believe not for joy and wonder. Luke 24 again. And they believe not for joy. What happened, man? We thought the man was dead and buried. Perhaps thinking in his grave. And they believe not for joy, overjoy. And they wonder, what happened? So he says, have you here any meat, something to eat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish and a honeycomb. And he took it and he ate in the very sight to prove what? And he had bit khanyam and poor hada uakhayat. I'm asking, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what was he trying to demonstrate? What? I'm the same fellow man, I'm not what you are thinking, I have not come back from the dead. This was Sunday evening after the alleged crucifixion. Let's go back what happened in the morning. John, your other witness, John chapter 20 verse 1, he tells us that it was Sunday morning, the first day of the week, when Mary Magdalene, she went to the tomb of Jesus. I'm asking John, why did she go there? Or let's put another of your witnesses, Mark, chapter 16, verse 1. Mark, as Mark tells us, why did Mary go there? And Mark tells us, she went to anoint him. Now the Hebrew word for anoint is masaha, from which we get the word Messiah in Hebrew and Masih in Arabic. The root word for both Arabic and Hebrew is the same. Masaha, which means to rub, to massage, to anoint. I'm asking, do Jews massage dead bodies after 3 days? And the answer is no. I said, you Christians, do you massage dead bodies after 3 days? Do you? The answer is no. We Muslims, we are the closest to the Jew in our ceremonial law. Do Muslims massage dead bodies after 3 days? The answer is no. Then why would they want to go and massage a dead rotten body after 3 days? Because within 3 hours, you know that rigor mortis sets in, the hardening of the cell, the rotting of the body, fermentation from within. In 3 days' time, the body is rotting from inside. Such a rotting body, when you massage it, falls to pieces. So why would she want to go and massage a dead rotten body? Unless she was looking for a live person. You see, according to your witnesses, from my reading, she must have seen signs of life in that limp body when it was taken down from the cross. Because she was about the only woman, besides Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who had given the final rites to the body of Jesus. All his other disciples had forsaken him and fled. They were not there. So if this woman had seen signs of life, she was not going to shout and say, hey, he's alive, to invite a sure death. 3 days later, she goes in and she wants to anoint him. And when she reaches the sepulcher, she finds that the stone is removed and the winding sheets inside. So she starts to cry. I'm asking, why was the stone removed? And why were the winding sheets unwound? Because for a resurrected body, you don't have to remove the stone to come out. For a resurrected body, you don't have to unwind the winding sheets to move. This is the need of this physical body, this mortal body. Because a poet tells us, the stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. For the soul, for the spirit, these things do not matter. Iron bars or walls. That's the need of this physical body. Jesus Christ, according to the scriptures, was watching her from wherever he was. Not from heaven, but from this earth. Because this tomb, if you remember, was a privately owned property belonging to Joseph of Arimathea, his very rich, influential disciple, who had carved out of a rock, a big holy chamber. Around that chamber was his vegetable garden. Now don't tell me that this Jew was so generous that he was planting vegetables 5 miles out of town for other people's sheep and goats to graze upon. Surely, he must have got his laborers' quarters. people to look after his garden and perhaps his country home, where he went with his family for holidays at the weekends. Jesus is there and he watches this woman. He knows who she is and he knows why she is there. And he goes up to her. He finds her crying. So he says, "Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou?" I'm asking, doesn't he know? Doesn't he know? Why does he ask such a silly question? I'm telling you, this is not a silly question. He's actually pulling her leg, metaphorically. Woman, from waarom ben jy hier sitte? She's supposing him to be the gardener. I'm only reading your evidence as it is given. She's supposing him to be the gardener. I'm asking, why does she suppose he's a gardener? Do resurrected bodies look like gardeners? Do they? She's supposing him to be the gardener. I said, why does she suppose he's a gardener? I'm telling you that because he's disguised as a gardener. Why is he disguised as a gardener? I say, because he's afraid of the Jews. Why is he afraid of the Jews? I say, because he didn't die and he didn't conquer death. If he had died and if he had conquered death, there's no need to be afraid anymore. Why not? Because the resurrected bodies can't die twice. Who says so? I say the Bible. What does it say? It says, it is ordained unto all men once to die, and after that the judgment. You can't die twice. So if he had conquered death, there would be no need to be afraid. He's afraid because he didn't die. So she's supposing him to be the God. Says, sir, if you have taken him hence, tell me where have you laid him to rest, to relax, to recuperate, not where have you buried him, so that I might take him away. I, alone, one woman, a frail Jewess, imagine her carrying away a purse of 160 pounds at least, not 200 like me. A muscular carpenter, supposed to be, young man in the prime of his life, at least 160 pounds. And another 100 pounds worth of medicines around him, according to John chapter 19, verse 39. That makes him 260. Can you imagine this frail Jewess carrying this bundle of her corpse of 260 pounds, like a bundle of straw, like a superwoman in the American comics? And take him where? Take it home, put it under a bed. What does she want to do with it? Want to pickle it? What does she want to do with a rotting body? I ask you. She wants to take him away, that I might take him away. This is your language. You must tell me, ladies and gentlemen, that in my language, when it is said a spirit has no flesh and bones, that it means a spirit has flesh and bones. This is how you have to correct me. You must tell me you don't understand English, Mr. Didak, or American English. That in America, when we say a spirit has no flesh and bones, it means a spirit has flesh and bones. When a woman says that I might take him away, it means she's got a troop with her. So Jesus, the joke had gone too far. So he says, Mary. The way he said Mary, she recognized that this was Jesus. So she wants to grab him. I'm asking why? To bite him? No, to pay respects. We Eastern people do. She wants to grab him. So Jesus says, touch me not. I say, why not? Is he a bundle of electricity, a dynamo, that if she touches him, she'll get electrocuted? Tell me, why not? I say, because it hurts. You give me another reason. Why not? Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended unto my Father. Is she blind? Can't she see the man is standing there beside her? What does it mean that I'm not gone up when he's here? He said, I'm not yet ascended unto my Father. In the language of the Jew, in the idiom of the Jew, he's saying, I am not dead yet. The problem arises. Who moved the stone? How could she get it? Who moved the stone? And the Christians are writing books upon books. One Frank Morrison, a rationalist lawyer, he writes a book of 192 pages and he gives 6 hypotheses. And at the end of the 192 pages, when you finish, you still haven't got the answer. Who moved the stone? And they're writing books upon books. Who moved the stone? I said, you know, I can't see. I can't understand. Why can't you see the very obvious? Why don't you read your books? These gospels, these evidence, you have it in black and white in your own mother tongue. This is an anomaly, that you read this book in your own mother tongue. The Englishman in English, the Afrikaner in Afrikaans, the Zulu in Zulu. Every language group has got the book in their own language. And each and everyone is made to understand the exact opposite of what he's reading. Exact opposite. Not just merely misunderstanding. I want you to prove me wrong. I'm telling you, I'm only quoting word for word. Exactly as your witnesses have said it, preserved it for us in that way. I'm not attributing motives to that. I'm not saying that they're dishonest witnesses. I'm telling you, please read this book of yours once more again without the blinkers. Remove the blinkers and read it once more again. And tell me where I'm not understanding your language. You Englishman or you Afrikaner or you Zulu, you come back to me. And if you feel at the end of the talk that our honored visitor has not done justice to the subject, you call me to your kingdom hall or to your school hall or anywhere you want to discuss further with me, I'm prepared to come. Who moved the stone? I am asking, it's very simple. They're talking about 20 men required. Because you are so huge, it needed a Superman from America to move it. 1.5 to 2 tons. I'm telling you, please read Mark and Matthew, and he tells you that Joseph of Arimathea alone he put the stone in place. One man. Alone! One man! If one man can put it in place, why can't 2 persons remove it, I ask you? Now, all those happenings, you know, that it was prophesied, it was ordained, and all the stories about what ought to have happened and what happened. I'm telling you that Jesus Christ had given you a clear-cut indication of what was going to happen. And that's also preserved in black and white in your testimony, in the Gospel of St. Matthew, another of the witnesses, chapter 38. I beg your pardon. Chapter 12, verses 38, 39, 40. The Jews come again to Jesus. Again to Jesus. With a new request. Now they say, Master, we would have a sign of thee. We want you to show us a miracle to convince us that you are the Messiah we are waiting for. You know, something supernatural. Like walking on the water. Flying the air like a bird. Do something, man. Then we will be convinced that you are a man of God. The Messiah we are waiting for. So Jesus answers them. He says, an evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, but there shall no sign be given unto it, except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the earth. The only sign he was prepared to give them was the sign of Jonah. He has put all his eggs in one basket. He didn't say, you know, blind Bartimaeus, I healed him. You know that woman with issues? She was bleeding for years. She touched me and she was healed. You know I fed 5,000 people with a few pieces of fish and a few pieces of bread. You know another 3,000 on another occasion. You know the fig tree I dried it up with from its very roots. Nothing ever happened. This is the only sign I'm going to give you is the sign of Jonah. I'm asking, what was that sign? Well, go to the book of Jonah. I brought the book of Jonah for you. One page. By God, it's only one page in the whole Bible. This is the book of Jonah. 4 short chapters. It won't take you 2 minutes to read it. Book of Jonah. This is the book of Jonah. One page. It's hard to find because in 1,000 pages, to find one page is difficult. But you don't have to go there. If you went to Sunday school, you will remember what I'm telling you.
I'm telling you that Jonah was sent to the Ninevites. You know, God Almighty told him, go to Nineveh, the city of 100,000 people, and warn them that they must repent in sackcloth and in ashes, humble themselves before the Lord and come right. Jonah, instead of going to Nineveh, he's despondent that these materialistic people, worldly people, they will not listen to me. They might make a mockery of what I have to tell them. So instead of going to Nineveh, he goes to Joppa. That's what this one book, one big book says. He went to Joppa. And he's taken a boat and he's going to Tarshish. You don't have to remember the names. On the way there's a storm. And according to the superstitions of these people, anyone who runs away from his master's command, who fails to do his duty, creates such a turmoil at sea. So they began to question in the boat, who could be responsible for this turmoil? Jonah realizes that as a prophet of God, he was a soldier of God. And as a soldier of God, he had no right to do things presumptuously on his own. So he says that, look, I'm the guilty party. God Almighty is after my blood. He wants to kill me. So in the process, he's in the boat. And you innocent people will die. It will be better for you if you take me and you throw me overboard. Because God is really after my blood. They say, no man, you know, you are such a good man, perhaps you want to commit suicide, we won't help you to do that. We have a system of our own of discovering right from wrong, and that is what they call by casting of lots, like head or tail, head or tail. So according to the system of casting lots, not throwing dice, it came to the turn of Jonah that Jonah was found to be the guilty man. And so they took him and they threw him overboard. Now I'm going to ask you a question. That when they threw him overboard, was he dead or was he alive? Now, before you answer, I want you to bear in mind that the man Jonah had volunteered. He said, throw me. And when a man volunteers, you don't have to strangle him before throwing. You don't have to spear him before throwing. You don't have to break his arm or limb before throwing. You agree with me? The man had volunteered. So when they threw him overboard, your common sense, what does it say? Was he dead or was he alive? Please, I want your help. Was he dead or was he alive? Alive. You get no prize for that. It was too simple a question. And astonishing, the Jews said he was alive, the Christians said he was alive, and the Muslims said he was alive. How much nicer it would be if we would agree on every other thing like that. We are all agreed that he was alive when he was thrown into that raging sea and the storm subsided. Perhaps it was a coincidence. A fish comes and gobbles him, dead or alive. Was he dead or was he alive? Alive! Thank you very much. From the fish's belly, according to the book of Jonah, he cries to God for help. Do dead men pray, Mr. Budina? Do they pray? Dead people, do they pray? No. Dead people pray. So he was alive. 3 days and three nights the fish chasing around the ocean, dead or alive? Alive. On the third day, vomits him on the seashore and asks him, dead or alive? Alive. What did Jesus say? He said, for as Jonah was, once was Jonah. Green dye and green nectar in the bait from the fruit of his rust. So shall the seal from the man's green dye and green nectar in the heart from the RBS. Gokuba, Tengo Jonah. Why is it Sisri? Sel Komo, Isin Sugu, Isin Tatu, Nobu Sugu, Obutatu, Kanjalo, again. Nem Baba, Yomundu, Uyaguba, Sabu Tunji, Bom Saba, Isin Sugu, Isin Tatu, Nobu Sugu, Obutatu. Just like Jonah, for as Jonah was, so shall the Son of Man be. Referring to himself. How was Jonah? Dead or alive? Alive. How was Jesus for 3 days and three nights in the tomb, according to the Christian belief? How was he? Dead or alive? Dead. He was dead. According to your belief. In other words, he's unlike Jonah. Can't you see? He said, I will be like Jonah, and you are telling me, these 1,200 million Christians of the world, that he was unlike Jonah. He said, I will be like Jonah, you say he's unlike Jonah. If I was a Jew,
I will not accept it as my Messiah. I am told in the Quran that Jesus was the Messiah. I accept. He was one of the mightiest messengers of God. I accept. I believe in his miraculous birth. I believe that he gave life to the dead by God's permission. And he healed those born blind and the lepers by God's permission. But if I was a Jew, according to the sign that he has given, he failed. Jonah is alive. Jesus is dead. They are unlike. I don't know in what language you can make them like, that they are like one another. So the clever man, you know, the doctor of theology, the professor of religion, he tells me that I don't understand the Bible. Your Bible, I don't understand. Why don't I understand the Bible? He says, you see, Mr. D-Dad, Jesus Christ is emphasizing the time factor. Look, he uses the word 3-4 times. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights. He uses the word 3-4 times. In other words, he's emphasizing the time factor, not whether he was dead or alive. I'm telling you that there is nothing miraculous in a time factor. Nothing miraculous about a time factor. Whether the man was dead for 3 minutes or 3 hours or 3 weeks. That's not a miracle. The miracle is, if at all, that you expect the man to be dead and he's not dead. When Jonah was thrown into the sea, we expect him to die. He didn't die, so it's a miracle. A fish comes and gobbles him, he ought to die. He didn't die, it's a miracle. 3 days and 3 nights, suffocation and heat in the whale's belly, he ought to die. He didn't die, it's a miracle. Because we expect a man to die and he didn't die. When we expect a man to die and he dies, what's miraculous about that? I ask you, what's miraculous about that? If a gunman took a gun and fired 6 shots into the hearts of Kennedy and he died, is that a miracle? No. But if he laughed it off, if he's still alive and walking with us, is this, you know, after the 6 shots tearing his heart to pieces, he laughed. He's alive. So it's a miracle. Can't you see? The miracle is when you expect the man to die and he doesn't die. The man when you expect him to die and he dies, there's no miracle. We expect Jesus also to die. For what he had been through, if he died, there's no miracle. There's no sign. If he didn't die, it's a miracle. Can't you see? So he said, no, it's the time factor. Drowning man clutches that straw. Drowning women do the same. He said, no, it's a time factor. I said, did you fulfill that? Oh, he said, of course, he fulfilled that. I said, how did you fulfill it? Look, it's very easy to make statements. How did he fulfill it? I said, watch. When was Jesus crucified, I asked you? The whole Christian world says Good Friday. In South Africa, we have a public holiday, Goeie Vrydag. Britain, France, Germany, America, Lesotho, Zambia, every Christian nation commemorates Good Friday. I am asking what makes Good Friday good. So the Christian says, Christ died for our sin. That makes it good. So he was crucified on a Good Friday. He said, yes. Yes. I said, when was he crucified, morning or afternoon? So they say, in the afternoon. How long was he on the cross? Some say 3 hours, some say 6 hours. I said, I'm not going to argue with you. Whatever you say, I accept. You know, when we read the scriptures, they tell us that when they wanted to crucify Jesus, they were in a hurry. And they were in such a hurry that Josh tells us in his book, The Resurrection Factor, that within some 12 hours, there were 6 separate trials. In 6 trials he went through. These things only happen in films. These sort of things, 6 trials in 12 hours from midnight till the next morning and carry on, 6 trials in 12 hours only take place on film. But I believe whatever you tell me. Whatever you tell me, I will accept. So, the Jews were in a hurry to put him up on the cross. Do you know why? Because of the general public. Jesus was the general public. They loved him. The man had healed the blind and the lepers and quickened the dead. He had fed so many thousands of people with bread and fish. He was the hero. And if they discovered, the general public, that the hero's life was in danger, they would have been a riot. So, they had a midnight trial. Early in the morning, they take him to Pilate. Pilate says, not my kettle fish taken to Herod. Herod says, I'm not interested, take him back to Pilate. And hurry. And they did 6 trials in 12 hours. 6. As if they had nothing else to do. But I believe what you tell me. They succeeded in putting him up on the cross. According to your witnesses. According to your witnesses. But as much as they were in a hurry to put him up, they were in a hurry to bring him down. You know why? Because of the Sabbath. Because at sunset on Friday, 6 o'clock, the Sabbath starts. You see the Jews, they count the days, night and day. We Muslims, we count our days, night and day. Not day and night. We count night and day. 6 o'clock, our day begins in the evening. So before sunset, the body must come down. Because they were told in the book of Deuteronomy that they must see to it that nobody is hanging on the tree on the Sabbath day, that thy land be not defiled with the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. So quickly, they brought the body down and they gave a burial bath. And they put 100 pounds weight of medicines around him and they put him into the sepulchre. Not a grave, sepulchre, a big roomy chamber above ground. So it's already evening. It's already evening. From 3 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever you do, and the burial bath, the details are given in Joshua's book. You know that burial bath alone will take more than an hour. You read the details, how the Jews give the burial bath to the dead. That takes more than an hour itself. But let's say they succeeded in doing all these things in a hurry. You know they were in a hurry. 6 trials in 12 hours. Now they put him into the sepulchre. By the time they put him in, it's already evening. So watch my fingers. Friday night, he's supposed to be in the grave. Watch my finger. Saturday day, he's still supposed to be in the grave. Am I right? Saturday night, he's still supposed to be in the grave. But Sunday morning, first day of the week, when Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb was empty. That's what your witnesses said. I'm asking how many days and how many nights. You remember? I said, supposed. You know why? Because the Bible doesn't say actually when he came out, he could have come out Friday night. But because the Bible doesn't say, I won't say it. So, Friday night, Saturday day, Saturday night. I'm asking, how many days and how many nights? Please, if you can see, if your eyes are not defective, tell me how many. How many do you see? How many? Huh? Right. 2 nights and a day. Look at this. Is it the same as this? He said, for as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights. 3 and 3, 3 and 3. Look at this, 2 and 1. Look at this. Please tell me now, it means the same thing. I want to know what you are reading. I want to know what you are reading in your own book. The man is telling you what is going to happen will be like Jonah. And the sign of Jonah is a miracle. And the only miracle we can attribute to this man Jonah is that we expect him to die and he didn't die. Jesus, we expect him also to die. If he died, it is not a sign. If he didn't die, it's a sign. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the verdict is there. Can you see? The people have been programmed. We all get programmed from childhood. When I went to America, Berkeley University in San Francisco, I was alleging against these American students and professors. I said, you people are brainwashed. I told them, you are brainwashed. Of course, I could afford to talk to them. The American can take it. He is the Almighty, you know, great guy. He can take it. I said, you people are brainwashed. So one American, you know, professor, he interjected. He said, no, not brainwashed, program. I said, I beg your pardon. Program. So, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I hope by the time this meeting is over, you will be reprogrammed into reading the book as it is and not as you are made to understand. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.